Now.
And welcome to the SVK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I'll be your host the next 15 minutes. We're coming live from the city of London, Shoreditch. So let's get down to business. We have a very special show in store for you today. We have a very special guest by the name of David Waxman. David is the CEO of Waxman PR. Waxman is the leading firm in the blockchain PR space, representing clients including Dash, CoinDesk, eToro, Crypto Valley, Lisk, and Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar. We talk in depth about David's journey into the blockchain space dating back to 2013, how Waxman PR has grown into the PR powerhouse they are today, the importance of network and relationships, trends David is currently seeing in the blockchain space today, and from working with some of the biggest and well-funded projects in the space, what excites David most and what is his future outlook? What does the future hold in his own words? If you haven't already, subscribe to the SVK Crypto Podcast. You know it makes sense, and make sure not to miss out on any other great episodes like today's. So with that in mind, strap yourself in and let's get into the interview. So on the show today, we have David Waxman, the CEO of the Waxman Group. David, how's it going?
It's going great. Great to be on here, Charles.
You know what, David? We have known each other for a little bit of time now, but I remember when we first met at Token 2049 and at one of your after party events, so one of the events that you were attending there, I knew I had to get you on the podcast. I knew I had to get your story out there. So I'm so grateful that you've made the time today.
Well, Charles, you've been introducing so many of the world leaders in this industry. It's an honor to be here, and I'm looking forward to having a lot of fun and talking with you about a whole number of things.
Well, let's make it happen. Well, like any great story, let's start at the beginning. David, where were you born?
I was born here in New York, so I'm presently in Manhattan, in Lower Manhattan, but I was born a little bit uptown and lived most of my life here in New York and thereabouts. So I'm a real New Yorker, and try to spend as much time here as I can.
And education, was that a big factor in your early years? Was that a big push for you? Were you an academic type? What kind of young individual were you?
Well, so my parents have kind of an interesting background, I guess. My mom's from Kansas and my dad's from Brooklyn, and they took kind of interesting pathways to more or less introduce me to education because it became very important to them. My mom became a lawyer. My dad became a neurosurgeon and then a lawyer himself. And there were lots of books always around the home, but what they didn't have is any appreciation for technology. That is to say, they simply didn't know anything about it. My father never learned how to type, never mattered to him. And so when I was able to go and get my hands on a computer at 9, 10, 11 years old, I was able to learn a whole lot about, well, something that my parents couldn't teach me and that couldn't be found in any of the books that lined our home. And I fell in love with literature. I fell in love with many tradition, with history, with many social sciences, with hard sciences as well. But I guess there was kind of two components of my education. There was the going to the proper schools, going to the boarding schools, et cetera, that I was able to do on one side. And the other was the self-education of learning about computers, learning about technology, of embracing what was, what became a rapidly maturing internet space in the 1990s when I was quite young. And I think the combination of those two things is what led me eventually to blockchain.
Which do you feel is more important? You know what I mean? Like, was it the education that you took upon yourself that you went out and learned? Or was it the academic type that you were learning in boarding school? Which do you feel has had the most value upon you?
Well, I actually think it's the confluence of both. And I'll tell you why. With what we do in public relations or communications or strategic consulting, it requires a command of language. And I don't know, I'm sure it's possible, but I don't know if I would have had such, let's call it a relationship with words, had I not been more or less forced to go and read a whole lot in school and thereabouts. And if I hadn't had access to great teachers, great professors, I don't know if I would have been really taught the right way to do things, or at least a right way to do things. You know, you can break the rules when it comes to writing and when it comes to grammar, but only if you really know them. Otherwise, what are you doing? You're just flopping about. And I think you need that to do what we do at Waxman quite well. That having been said, there's no way to learn in school, or at least there certainly wasn't when I was coming up, to learn about blockchain, for instance. It just didn't exist. There were no courses on blockchain. There were no courses on crypto. And who were you going to learn from? Even the early books that I read, and some of them were fascinating, written by some of the best journalists in the world, people I have great respect for. Some of what they were writing, by the time it hit print, by the time it could get in my hands as a reader, it was already out of date. So I think it really needs to be that combination of traditional learnings, of really having a worldview that's impacted by far more than what you might see on a news website, one that's impacted by cultivating a love of history, a love of science. Combine that with everything we have instant access to on the internet, and I think that might be the perfect combination.
That's interesting. And when did you realize you had a knack for PR and really saw the power of communication? It seems like this was something that you figured out. What kind of age were you when you realized the power within that?
So it's kind of an interesting story. My father, as I mentioned, was a neurosurgeon lawyer, but the way he was able to go and accumulate clients was kind of fascinating. In the 1990s, in the United States, I should mention, I'm not sure if this is the case in other places, but everyone used to watch, instead of reality TV, they would watch talk shows. So there were these talk shows on every channel all the time, or seemingly all the time, by these talk show hosts who would bring on sometimes crazy people, sometimes very sane people, and they would have all these different segments, and they needed to fill up their rosters. And so my dad, he hired a public relations agency in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. They worked a lot together. And that agency was able to help book him on all sorts of different talk shows. They were able to book him a lot of opportunities to have thought leadership by the authorship and contribution of op-eds to top publications. And what happened was, as he appeared on these talk shows as an expert, because he was this expert in medical malpractice, he was able to go and get a lot of notoriety. And that notoriety translated into great clients. And those great clients translated into a lot of victories for him and his firm. And from 1983 until 1996, when he retired, he never lost a case. In part because he was very good at what he did, but also because he had great clients. And again, he got a lot of those clients through PR. So fast forward a little while, and I had an opportunity to be an intern at the PR agency that my dad had used in the first place. That is to say, he was actually client number one in this new thing. Yes, and so I learned about PR, what PR was, from my manager at the time, who was this extraordinary woman named Colleen. And Colleen had previously been the press secretary for the city of New York, reporting to Mayor Rudy Giuliani. So she had seen absolutely everything under the sun, and we were actually working primarily with nonprofits. That's what I was doing when I was an intern. But I saw how it could impact nonprofits, and I was learning from such a professional that I learned that there was power to this. Because I didn't want to just be someone selling someone else's products. I didn't like the idea of that. But then I learned that public relations is far more than that. You help define a message. You help take great ideas and bring them to life. And you help broadcast those ideas so great ideas can impact many people. And when I had an opportunity to help organizations helping soldiers with post-traumatic stress, or to help organizations that were trying to feed children, and I saw that the work I was doing in trying to help convince a newspaper reporter or getting a radio station to potentially go and book an interview with one of these founders, that was actually going to feed more children, or it was going to go and help more soldiers returning from war. Well, that actually had an impact. And that taught me that there was power to PR far beyond what you might think on the surface.
And that's interesting, because obviously your father sounds like he was a role model to you. Did he speak very openly about his strategy? Was it something that he would discuss with you? Was it something that he would speak fondly of? Or was it something that you kind of saw for yourself from his own actions?
Well, he was proud of it. He didn't hide the fact that he was working with a PR agency. It helped him do his job.
Right.
And I think that's very important. Waxman, what we do is 99% is behind the scenes, and it should be. We're not the story. The story is our clients. They're what's fascinating. That's what we're obsessed with. That's why we wake up in the morning, is to work with them and help tell their stories. But we're their partner. We love working with organizations, learning everything they're about, helping them solve their problems, and helping go and tell the very best version of their story, so that through a medium, through real news, audiences can derive something of value. That's what really matters. And so he was quite open about it. And I think that was something important to me. And what I've noticed in working with clients the world over at Waxman, we've worked with 150, 200 companies in blockchain, is that it is an honor to be their partner. And it's something that we take with a point of pride. It's why we are proud to put logos on our website of our clients, why we're proud to stand with them at conferences all over the world, at Token 2049 and others. I think it's a type of truly mutually beneficial partnership if done right.
I couldn't agree more. What was the original vision behind Waxman? What created this? Was it from your passion in PR? But then you also had a blockchain mix onto that as well. And you're very early when Waxman came around. It's 2013. What was the original vision and how did it all come around?
So actually, it was the beginning of 2014, Charles. And the reason I'll tell you why I know that it's cemented into memory is I felt I had completely missed the boat. That is to say, what we had seen in 2013 was a rise of Bitcoin from $7 to $1,200. This happened in 2017 alone. And Bitcoin went from being something that maybe if you were a reader of very technical websites, you would have some knowledge of. And there was actually a Bitcoin community, of course, in 2011, 2012, but it was quite small. In 2013, however, the price rise resulted in significant interest from VCs. And those VCs started putting money in crypto companies and exchanges primarily. And one of those exchanges actually became my first ever client. But at the end of 2013, of course, was the Mt. Gox disaster. And it was after that, and with the sudden and long collapse of Bitcoin price, that I learned about Bitcoin. So what happened was I was in here in New York, and I went to a bar called Sweet and Vicious, and I met the CEO of a Bitcoin exchange. And he was one of the smartest, sharpest people I'd ever met. And he had this problem. You see, he was selling Bitcoin on this exchange for US dollars, and they weren't that differentiated when it comes to their brand from the other Bitcoin exchanges that existed at the time. And it turned out that I was doing PR. I was leading the day-to-day for an agency, a boutique agency in New York. I knew how to differentiate companies in the media. That is to say, start introducing them to the right reporters, helping take the same exact story and have it make slightly more impact. And I didn't do this with puffy words or with a lot of nonsense. It was basically simply by telling the story and arranging it in a way that made sense for the reporters so that they could get as energized and excited about it perhaps as the founders themselves or as the customers of the exchange who were going to be using this. And so when introducing something like a fix API was something that we did with CoinSetter, that actually was able to make some waves with the right community because we were able to tell that story, I believe, pretty well. So long story short, I started doing real PR, traditional PR, working with real estate developers, cosmetics companies, manufacturers, you name it, we worked with it, restaurant chains. But I fell in love with Bitcoin and with crypto in early 2014, and I simply couldn't shake it. So when 2015 came around, and I had been working with the Bitcoin exchange for, you know, at this point, well over a year, and I had been introduced to all the various partners that work with a Bitcoin exchange. So you're talking about miners, you're talking about Forex platforms, you're talking about lots of different organizations that rely on an exchange more or less as their on or off ramp at the very least to this world. And that taught me a lot about the Bitcoin space. And in 2015, I decided to specialize. That is to say, I wanted to work in Bitcoin full time. So I was able to rustle up a software wallet called Airbits, a hardware wallet called Trezor, and they had a mining pool called Slush Pool as well, the first ever, a Bitcoin ATM network called CoinSource, and a blockchain-focused VC. And with those as my starting clients, I went and launched Waxman, which was at the time called Waxman PR. And because Bitcoin didn't pay the bills, I even had to work with some fintech companies, quote unquote, traditional ones, because there was no money in Bitcoin anymore. I mean it. Like, all the VCs had pulled out. There was a two-year bear market, and no one wanted to put money in. But this is what I wanted to do. I saw so many smart people in the space. I loved the philosophy. I loved the industry. I loved the atmosphere and the energy. And I just had to do it.
What was your vision, though, going back to those years? What was your vision? Did you ever have kind of the grand picture in your head when you first met the CEO of the Bitcoin exchange, CoinSense? Did you ever kind of, did it all kind of click into place? Was it like, okay, I see how big this is going to be and I see my place within that?
Absolutely not. So let me explain. When I met Jaren, I was obsessed with being able to go and work in this very exciting new field, and I learned a lot about it. And when I started Waxman, All I wanted to do was have an opportunity to work on the clients that I really wanted to work on. And I like working on many things at once and being able to help multiple organizations in different strains. And I wanted it to be in the industry that I really cared about. That's it. So I would have been very happy, to be honest with you, having two associates working with me, working on a handful of clients, and just doing that all day long. I would have been absolutely happy. What I couldn't possibly know at the time, and I'm not going to pretend to have had some sort of epic vision, was that in 2016, the crypto space would go from less than $6 billion in combined market cap to $17 billion, effectively tripling. And I couldn't even further expect that in 2017, it would go from $17 billion to near $800 billion in just 1 year. But I was at the right place at the right time. And fairly early on, I recognized that I had this extraordinary opportunity. And so my dreams expanded, no question. And what became possible has significantly expanded. And the clients that I could work with significantly expanded. And I realized in a way that I could never have before, quite how borderless this industry is, quite how global it is, and quite how exciting it could be.
I love to hear that. It was the passion that got you involved. It was the passion that kept you going, even through the bear market conditions you were faced. It was the passion.
Oh, boy. I got to tell you one thing, Charles. So in late 2015, my agency had just kind of started, and I went to San Diego for a conference. And this was an amazing conference. Patrick Byrne from Overstock at the time announced that essentially he had received, let's call it tacit permission from the Securities Exchange Commission to trade equities, their own equities, I believe, on the Overstock platform called T0. This was unbelievable, mind-blowing stuff. And so he was one of the keynote, he was the keynote speaker at this event called Inside Bitcoin's San Diego. But the exhibit hall, which was next door to the speaker lounge, or where the speakers, I should say, were talking, was completely empty. I mean, it was this cavernous airplane hangar-like space, just gigantic. You could park a 747 in it. And there may have been four booths. Three of them were given away. So there was only one paying booth. And there were all these huge like picnic tables. I don't even know if tablecloths were on them, but there were dozens and dozens of them. And the room was totally empty. And I looked at that and I said, with the price of Bitcoin essentially dropping for 2 years, I mean, with my PR hat on, I should say, I looked around the room and I said, if a reporter wanted to say that Bitcoin is dead, all they needed to do was come in the room and take a photo, and they had conclusive proof. Because here it is, the Bitcoin space in California at the end of 2015, and no one's here. Well, fortunately, that wasn't the case. Fortunately, we saw an incredible resurgence. But yes, it was the passion for this industry, I believe. I love the people. It's not just the technology. I'm telling you, technology is just technology. Blockchain is wonderful. It may solve a lot of problems. That's great. But it's the people behind it. It's the IQ points flooding into it. It's the creativity in this industry that I think is so incredible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So talk to me a little bit about Waxman's strategy, because this is obviously something that has really taken Waxman PR to the heights of where it is now. You mentioned before about being a partner, being kind of behind the scenes, making it happen. What is your strategy? How do you help projects?
Well, we help them in two primary ways, and we've dabbled in a couple others. But I'll talk to you about the primary ways that Waxman helps organizations around the world. The first is with real PR, what I mentioned earlier. And what that means is it's not all marketing. So we don't do advertising. We don't do social, really. We don't do any community management. We don't do direct mail or TV ads or anything like that. What we do is what I call traditional public relations, primarily earned media and owned media support. And so to define that in terms that actually make any sense at all, we help our clients get in the news by figuring out what a company's message really should be. Let's call it defining their brand and defining it in a number of different ways to the proper audiences. And then we take that framework and we help figure out a strategy for maximizing press releases or announcements that a company may have over a period of time. And while doing so, we work very often, it depends on a case-by-case basis, to work with our clients to amplify them, the principals in that organization or the spokespeople, by virtue of helping establish them as thought leaders or reestablishing them or maintaining the momentum that they may have had previously with that. The combination of those two things, of maximizing announcements, of establishing thought leadership, of ensuring that our clients are getting the best press possible, that's very important when you're trying to go and build exposure for a new technology, a new organization. There's a flip side to it. The same type of, let's call it traditional PR, also helps us protect companies. And we do a whole lot of that. And sometimes that's crisis communications when something very bad happens. Sometimes it's simply by making sure that mistakes aren't made. It's very easy for a positive announcement to go the wrong way simply because you wrote a sentence incorrectly. It's unbelievable, but it's true. It's very easy to misinterpret something. A comma inappropriately placed can have actual impact on the definition and meaning of that sentence. So that's something that we do all the time for clients. We help them get in the real news, and we help do that by simply talking to reporters who, I should mention over and over, turn us down almost all the time. That is to say, even with the very best story, we're going to get turned down a lot, and we're okay with rejection. And we often have to go and talk to our clients and explain to them that if you work with real reporters, there's no pay for play, and there shouldn't be. It's unethical. What you have to do is simply talk to them, ask them if they're interested in something, provide them with something that could be of interest, and get rejected most of the time. That's how it works. So that's on the earned media side. On owned media side, if someone has a blog or some other channel, we may help our clients craft messaging or edit their messaging so that it really impacts the audience correctly. So we'll do that with owned channels, which might be, as I said earlier, blogs or social or something along those lines, where you have command, you being the company, have command of what's actually going to appear. Because in the real news, you have no control. Reporters, editors, they have complete control and autonomy, and they should. So that's what Waxman does on the PR side. And then I'll finish up by telling you a little bit about the events department. So in 2017, I realized that there were so many conferences, it was impossible to keep track of what was going on. And so we began what became the Waxman events team, which is currently in our New York and Dublin offices, and the Dublin office services APAC as well. And they're a team of professional event organizers that come from the very best places. And they help us vet all the events on earth and help our clients figure out where to go, when, and how. We help conferences with some of their back end. And we help our clients do everything from throw parties to conferences to private dinners on the production side as well. And so last year, for instance, and it's been a kind of a crazy year and change, but the Waxman events team vetted more than 800 events on behalf of our clients around the world, more than 800.
Wow.
So those are the two primary services, I would say, that Waxman offers. We do some strategic consulting. We've helped our clients with recruiting, but I'd say that's how Waxman is best defined and best known.
So we'd love to hear. So on the first kind of slope that you spoke about, the PR, I think there was a few things that caught my interest there. One is the fact that Waxman was really pioneering the approach of getting mainstream news to pick up the stories. And it's interesting that you mentioned that it's hard to sell to the reporters. I'd love to know your secrets, your tips to getting reporters to report on the news. Is it just being passionate? Is it being able to communicate your message clearly to them? What from your experience helps push your story out? How do you convince these people?
The first and most important thing by far is understand your audience. And in this case, understand their audience too. So let's kind of unpack what that means. Reporters at Fortune magazine are unlikely to care about a small technical improvement, not because the reporters themselves might not be passionate about the industry or care about the technology, but they have to be considerate of who their audience is. Their audience might not be looking for something that is a 3% transaction per second improvement. If it's not going to have a wider economic impact, if it's not going to impact in a material way the readers of Fortune magazine, they can't report about that. It would be doing a disservice to their editors, to their readers, etc. So you need to think that way first. So first, every time you're going to go and approach a reporter, determine who their audience is, what their audience might care about. Then each individual reporter, they've got their own style. They've got their own narratives. They've got their own editorial angles that they want to approach. Understand that to the best of your ability. And the best way to do that is by asking and by having a trusted friendship and relationship where you can go and have an idea as to what they're thinking about now, what they find interesting today, what they might write about tomorrow. Understanding that in the best of circumstances, you're going to get rejected way, way more often than you won't. This gives you, I'd call, a pathway to determine what to pitch, when, how, to various specific reporters, and that gives you the best opportunity to go and land a placement down the road. That's pretty much how it works. I know there's a lot of steps involved. There's a lot of man hours involved in the process. It does require maintenance of relationships with media the world over, because reporters need to trust someone to at least start their own investigations. And if they won't even open up your email in the first place because they know that you can't be trusted, you'll be very unlikely to go and get your story out there with the reporters you care about.
And trust is built over time from the relationship that you mentioned. That is something that, I guess, it's like a small plant growing. You got to keep watering it. You got to keep looking after it. And one day it will flourish.
That's exactly right. And what we've done at Waxman, and this is, I'd say, one of the accomplishments I'd say I'm most proud of, is that thus far, we've been able to go and establish trust with many, many reporters the world over, because it is our primary imperative to do so. This is the thing that we work hardest about. If a reporter says, take me off of your email list, please don't send me an email, we won't. If a reporter says, I only want to hear from one member of the Waxman team, well, that's how it is. We do our very best to do so. And I personally, when I meet with editors of publications, I ask them, how are my people doing? How are we doing as an organization? How are our clients doing? What do you find interesting? What do you not find interesting? What can I do to make things better? And we continuously iterate and refine and improve. And we do so in order to continue to have a trusted relationship with journalists. Because at the end of the day, our relationship with them is what allows us to best provide opportunities for our clients. But we can't ever let that go. We can't let our guard down. We can't make mistakes. We really can't. And so that's what we strive to do. And to do so at scale from multiple different offices with many clients being serviced simultaneously, that's a challenge that I'd say is something I'm most proud of embracing.
That's perfect. And one of the things that I feel you do really well is finding trends, right? Seeing the trends in the overall market, seeing where the attention is, and then being able to sell the story on the back of that, being able to communicate the message. Why is this happening? What is this trend? Let me explain it. Let me show you how it works. Do you feel that's a big factor in it as well? Where is the interest? Where is the attention?
100%. And the best way to stay on top of what's in the news is perhaps by helping, well, be part of it in the first place. And so in talking to reporters and talking to the leading companies, and this is why I love going to conferences, and I would suggest that as many people go to conferences as they can, it gives you an opportunity to talk to the most exciting entrepreneurs and the people premiering new things. So talking to those people, asking them every question under the sun gives you, I think, a broad understanding that lets you spot trends. And being able to do so means that you can, well, provide, in our case, news to reporters that's actually new and salient. So when we saw early on that stablecoins were going to be a big thing, and consequently, we were fortunate enough to work with some of the leading stablecoin teams. We saw that security tokens were a giant part of the future of the blockchain space. And so in starting with T0 and then working with other top organizations in the space, we were able to do that early on and help those organizations tell their story of how they see the future unfolding. And this is the same with many, many other trends. I was very lucky to work with Steemit before they even launched, and to work with them all the way through their launch and for a very long time, because I was able to go and therefore understand how DPoS blockchains just might be a version of the future. And certainly we've seen so with EOS, a lot of that taking off. We were able to work with some of the leading proof of stake chains very early on, and we were able to ask a lot of questions to the brilliant minds behind that to understand how it worked, so we could actually say, listen, I think this is worth supporting and figuring out how best to embrace this type of technology with, for instance, Cardano. And you know, working with these types of organizations, you learn enough to know what already exists. And this is important because you can't determine what's new or what's interesting unless you have an understanding of what already exists today. You need that context. And someone who's just jumping into the space, they're going to have a learning curve for sure.
Couldn't agree with you more. Now, on the subject of trends, you've lived through the bear market 2013-14. What are you seeing now, right? So being in a position where you're speaking to some of the largest projects in the space, some of the most well-funded teams in the space, I mean, in your own words, what does the future look like for the blockchain space? What are you seeing? What are the trends that you've picked up on?
Well, there's certainly a lot of change, but the first thing I should say is it does feel, I don't know like what's going to happen, of course, but it does feel like crypto spring. It really does. That is to say, we are seeing a level of positivity and excitement that I haven't seen in quite some time. It's a refined sense of excitement, I should say. This is not the hyperbolic rush of late 2017. I don't see that. What I'm seeing is better teams today. When we're vetting and doing diligence on new business, on a rate basis, the average potential client is far better than they used to be. The teams are more sophisticated. They bring enormous experience outside of blockchain and oftentimes a lot of experience in blockchain. And this is important because in 2016, very few people had more than a couple years experience in the industry. And there were very few companies that even had that. Go to 2017 and you had a lot of brand new people just throwing out ideas. But now in 2019, what we're seeing is people who have been interested in the space for 1, 2, 3 years, 4 years, who have put together sophisticated technology, sophisticated teams, and the business development marketing apparatuses that are required to bring a product to market or a service to market. We're seeing that now. So what I'm trying to say is the trend is towards more fully baked projects, towards products that actually work immediately, to products that are actually going to be good and reviewable and competitive with each other. That's what we're seeing now. My hope is that we see a lot more of this, because if we're ever going to get the type of mainstream adoption that the crypto community has been clamoring for since the beginning of time, we're going to go and need to see projects that actually work the way consumers and traditional businesses, well, kind of what they're used to. It's going to have to look and feel like that, even if it operates differently or more efficiently. And so I think we're now seeing the teams that have the strengths to go and pull off products and services that those consumers and businesses require.
I completely agree. Now, the final question, Dave, what are you most excited about?
I'm excited about, I know this sounds hokey, but I'm excited about true consumer adoption. And by that, I mean, I would like a future where people have many forms of payment on their phones without them even realizing that they're necessarily different forms of payment. I'd like to see microeconomies flourish, and I'd like to see that impact be something that we could study and then use to impact larger economies too in a beneficial way. So my hope is that the game theory, the hard science, the multidisciplinary approach that has made blockchain such a fascinating subject for those of us fully in the mix, my hope is that the learnings from that have a wider impact. And I think that what we're seeing now with some true consumer grade and enterprise organizations utilizing blockchain and the learnings of blockchain in their new practices, I think that's going to have a big impact. And I'm excited to see how that unfolds.
There's a lot happening. There's a lot going on. Listen, thank you so much for your time, David. I know you're super busy. And thank you for giving us an insight into what goes down behind the scenes, how you make it happen, and everything that you've been doing and contributing to the space. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Charles. Great to be on here.
I want to say a big thank you once again for David for making it on the show today. We really appreciate your support and you sharing your story with us and the listeners out there. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to the SVK Crypto Podcast, to follow us on Twitter at @SVK_crypto, to hit us up on Telegram. If you type in SVK crowd, you will find us. If you have any further questions or queries, feel free to email myself, cstory, C-S-T-O-R-R-Y, @svkcrypto.com. That is a wrap and I've got to bounce.